A 36-year-old neurosurgeon stands before a CT scan, but this time, he's not analyzing a patient's fate. He's staring at his own. Paul Kalanizi had spent years guiding families through impossible decisions about life and death. Now, with stage 4 lung cancer spreading through his lungs, spine, and liver, he faced the ultimate role reversal. The future he'd meticulously built, completing his residency, launching his dream career, starting a family, vanished in the time it took to read a radiology report. This wasn't supposed to happen to someone so young, so accomplished, so careful. Yet here he was, transformed from healer to patient in a single breath, forced to confront the questions he'd helped others navigate. How do you live when your future disappears? What makes life meaningful when time becomes your most precious and dwindling resource? For months, Paul ignored alarming symptoms: 40 pounds lost, debilitating back pain, a persistent cough after California's wildfire smoke cleared. Despite being a physician who recognized these red flags, his 100-hour neurosurgical residency weeks left no room for personal health concerns. During a solo trip to New York, excruciating spasms left him barely able to walk. Taking cabs for short distances, stopping to catch his breath on stairs, he finally admitted to a friend, "I think I have cancer, and not the good kind." An abnormal chest x-ray followed. Lucy met him at the airport with a promise, "I will never leave you." The transformation from confident physician to vulnerable patient happened instantly when he changed from scrubs to a hospital gown. But understanding how to live whatever remained would become his final and most profound journey. Neurosurgery answered Paul's deepest questions about identity and mortality. The brain isn't just an organ, it's the physical substrate of consciousness itself. Beneath his instruments lay memories, personalities, dreams. Each surgery carried philosophical weight, unmatched by other specialties. The demands were crushing: 100-hour weeks, 6-hour surgeries requiring microscopic precision while fighting exhaustion. A millimeter mistake could mean paralysis or permanent personality change. Paul operated on Matthew, a college student with a massive brain tumor. After 16 hours, he saved Matthew's life but couldn't preserve his speech. Months later, when Paul apologized, Matthew wrote, "It's okay. I know you did everything you could. And look, I can still write." These moments of grace sustained Paul through impossible decisions. How aggressively to pursue tumor removal versus preserving function? When does treatment's burden outweigh its benefits? What gives life meaning beyond survival? The irony wasn't lost on him that these same questions would soon dominate his own existence, forcing him to discover whether he was more than his professional achievements. Becoming a patient transformed Paul's relationship with medicine. His expertise became both blessing and curse. He understood exactly what his body endured, what each treatment meant, what the statistics implied. When his oncologist mentioned chemotherapy's potential for neuropathy, Paul immediately grasped the implications for his surgical career. Yet this knowledge couldn't answer the questions that mattered most. He found himself obsessively researching survival statistics, despite knowing their limited applicability. He experienced the same scan anxiety he'd previously dismissed in others, that creeping dread before imaging results. Time became double-edged. Each day brought him further from his last relapse, but closer to the next recurrence. Should he return to surgery, knowing he might not survive to see patients recover? Should he write instead, leaving behind words that might outlast him? His verb conjugation became muddled. I am a neurosurgeon, I was a neurosurgeon, or I had been a neurosurgeon before and will be again. His identity existed in an uncertain tense, forcing him to reconsider what makes life worthwhile when the future disappears. Paul chose to honor both vocations, returning to surgery with his oncologist's blessing while beginning to write, rising at 5 a.m. before rounds or staying up late despite chemotherapy's exhaustion. When treatment caused painful fissures on his fingertips, Lucy found silver-lined gloves so he could continue typing. Most significantly, Paul and Lucy decided to have a child despite his prognosis. When friends questioned this, "Won't saying goodbye make death more painful?" Paul responded immediately, "Easier, perhaps, but not better." Holding newborn Katie against his chest, he felt both the weight of impending separation and the transcendent connection of parenthood. His literary training provided navigation tools. He revisited T.S. Eliot's Meditations on Time, found solace in C.S. Lewis on suffering, quoted Beckett's "I can't go on, I'll go on." Language became both therapy and legacy. "Words have a longevity I do not," he observed. His focus narrowed to essential questions, not what career achievements remained possible, but what makes even a shortened life worth living. He found answers in small, transcendent moments, reading poems to Katie, feeling Lucy's head against his chest, watching California sunlight filter through redwoods. Cancer stripped away pretense from Paul and Lucy's relationship, revealing its essential strength. His demanding residency had created distance, but crisis transformed their love into something simpler and deeper. "We joked with close friends that the secret to saving a relationship is terminal illness," Lucy wrote, dark humor masking profound truth. Katie's birth, 8 months before Paul's death, brought what he called a joy unknown to me in all my prior years. Watching them together, he found peace knowing they would have each other. In his final hours, Lucy held his fingers, stroked his hair, whispered, "You're a brave paladin," and sang their favorite jingle. She pressed Katie's cheek against Paul's, their matching dark hair askew, for a farewell the infant couldn't comprehend. As darkness fell, Paul inhaled and released one final deep breath. Now, Lucy visits his grave in the Santa Cruz Mountains, bringing Madeira wine from their honeymoon and pouring some on the grass. When she finds flowers eaten by deer, she thinks it's a use Paul would have appreciated, the inextricability of life and death. Paul's legacy poses a question we all face. What gives life meaning when we can't control our time? His answer wasn't achieving greatness before death, but finding meaning within life's constraints. "You can't ever reach perfection," he wrote, "but you can believe in an asymptote toward which you are ceaselessly striving, a mathematical line continuously approaching but never reaching a limit." This became his philosophy. Perfection remained unreachable, but the striving itself created meaning. His final message echoes, "When you come to one of the many moments in life where you must give an account of yourself, do not discount that you filled a dying man's days with a sated joy. We're all terminal. Some just have clearer timelines. The question isn't how much time we have, but what we do with the uncertainty we're given." Paul chose surgery, writing, fatherhood, and love, despite knowing the end was near, demonstrating that meaning doesn't require endless time, only presence. His words ask us, what are you doing with your one precious life? Not someday, but now, in this breath, before it becomes air.